Well, welcome to Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host. It's 3 o'clock in Juneau. We have guests today from the National that are going to talk to us about National Child Abuse Prevention Month. George Brown and Brian Messing will be here. The League of Women Voters will drop by to talk about Vision 2020. Some folks from UAS will be telling us about the book launch for Tidal Echoes. And we'll have folks from the school district telling us about how to register our children for kindergarten. The weather looks really fine. Partly cloudy, scattered rain showers are forecast for later this afternoon, but sure is sunny out there right now. Highs around 52, southeast winds 15 miles per hour. And tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 37 and light winds.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Survivors of Canada's Indian residential school system gathered in Victoria, British Columbia for 2 days of hearings by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, one of the speakers at the emotional gathering was a First Nation leader.
Grand Chief Ed John wept uncontrollably as he told the commission that he never fully realized the impact of the Indian residential schools on his life until he heard other survivors tell their stories at the hearings. He said the stories tore open wounds he never realized were there.
It was through us that our languages were to die, but we were children, we didn't know. So to the survivors, it is a mixed up place.
Another survivor, Alice George, attended the Port Alberni Residential School. She says the experience hurt, but she hopes the hearings can help.
I've always been scared, and I still am scared, but I'm starting to speak out a lot better and more. And I want it better for me and my grandchildren and my kids, so they can have a little bit of a better life. So I think this will help to heal a lot.
As many as 2,000 people attended the two-day gathering. It included traditional ceremonies and survivor gatherings as well as formal statements. The commission is trying to help survivors heal by allowing them to tell their stories. It's also creating a historical record of Canada's Indian residential school system. The commission's interim report, published in February, found that Canadians know very little about First Nations people and residential schools. It recommended the education system be used to inform students about the neglect, physical, and sexual abuses suffered at the schools. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Winnemin Wintu tribe in Northern California is calling on the U.S. Forest Service to close a portion of a public waterway near a lake for privacy during tribal coming-of-age ceremonies. Christina Onnestad has more.
The puberty ceremony is held for Winnemin Wintu girls transitioning into womanhood. For 4 days and nights, men and women sing and dance along the McLeod River, a tributary of Shasta Lake. The U.S. Forest Service issues a voluntary closure along the small river, but according to Chief Colleen Sisk Franco, there's the 10% of people who still disrupt their ritual.
Speedboats come up and they yell at people. I mean, they yell obscenities.
A video shot by Moving Images Productions shows a speedboat riding past the ceremony as a woman flashes the group, screaming. Since 2005, the tribe has asked the local Forest Service to close the McLeod River to the public while they hold their ceremony. Now they're taking their plea to the regional Forest Service manager. John Heil is a spokesperson for the United States Forest Service.
We understand their concerns. We're going to take it seriously, and we're going to review the information they provided us and get back to them.
According to Heil, the Forest Service takes each request on a case-by-case basis. And for the Winnemin Wintu, their request may have extra hurdles, since the tribe isn't recognized as being one, according to the United States government anyway. Sis says she hopes to receive an answer by early May. The tribe's next puberty ceremony is scheduled this July. Christina Onnestad, National Native News, California.
During this month in 2011, Marjorie Tawbone was named Miss Indian World at the Gathering of Nations powwow in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tawbone, who's Inupiaq and Kiowa, was raised in Nome, Alaska. She also held the title of Miss World Eskimo Indian Olympics. The new Miss Indian World will be crowned April 28th. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, three-and-a-half-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2013. Applications will be accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore hosting Juneau Afternoon today. My first two guests are a couple of gentlemen who are part of a Safe Child Advocacy Center here in Juneau. Brian Messing is the program director, and George Brown is a pediatrician of some standing who's worked on child abuse problems here in Juneau for a number of years. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the Safe Child Advocacy Center?
It's a program that has been in place since 2001, and it was it's based from a national program from the National Children's Alliance and the National Child Advocacy Center movement. And basically what it is it's a program that brings team members together that are involved in child abuse cases where there are allegations of child. The cases that we take are either child sexual abuse or severe physical abuse cases, and where there's involvement of investigation, whether forensic interviews, medical exams done on site. Here we have a center here in Juneau where we bring team members that are involved in the actual process come to one building one time to try to minimize the trauma to families and to children, and to get it all done in one setting so they don't have to have multiple interviews and different things like that.
Who all would be the members of the team?
Well, we have the initial ones are investigators with law enforcement. Most of them are Juneau Police Department. We have Office of Children's Services, where they deal with child safety issues within the home. And then we have prosecution department, we have mental health, we have medical, we have victim advocacy, we have cultural groups, we have, that's all I can think of right off the top of my head.
Brian, what triggers SAFE's involvement in one of these cases? When is your organization chosen to be the site for the investigation?
Well, we take referrals through law enforcement or Child Protection Service whenever there's an allegation of child sexual abuse or physical abuse that raises to their screening process, a priority one screening process, and we'll take those cases day or night, set up the interview as soon as we can, and then if there's a medical exam needed, we will have a contracted doctor come in that's been trained.
In addition to the team, how many staff do you have?
On staff?
Yeah.
At the Child Advocacy Center, there's three of us.
Okay. So now, George, are you one of the doctors that might be called in on this?
Yes. Okay. I've been doing that now. There, I guess it's about 2002.
Okay. And you do that because you're also trained as a pediatrician. You in practice here in town?
Yeah, well, we have we can have nurse practitioners in a lot of advocacy centers that do this, family practitioners. Doesn't have to be a pediatrician.
Uh-huh.
And one of the doctors is also a OBGYN. But we have special training, and we continue this, and we coordinate with the other, I think there's seven other CACs in the state, and we coordinate with their medical people, so that we are being kept up to date all the time.
So when you say special training, what kinds of things have you had
the forensic medical examination in which you are, as we were talking before the program, we're trying to come up with the most objective evidence to put the story together, to be objective and to come to the what really happened, because in the long run, that's what's going to help the family and the child the best.
And that's a for any physician, that would be like a post-medical school training process.
Yes, that's right.
Something you decide to do. Why were you called to that?
Well, I've been working in the field of preventing child abuse really since the late 60s when I learned from the team in Denver, Dr. Henry Kemp, and they pioneered all of this. And I like to point out that really until the 50s, society was very good at denying that this really occurred. And it was around all the time. This is really true with sexual abuse. And he broke that barrier. Social workers have been doing this work for a long time, but it involved the whole community, and that's the big difference. And so as a pediatrician, I've been involved with that a long time.
Now, we've drawn a picture here of an agency where the law enforcement division is triggering an investigation, which you more or less host, and you bring in experts such as George. Is there a wider role for community members in preventing child abuse? And does your organization work with that?
Yes, there are several things that people can do. Number one, they can learn about child abuse through community awareness. We have some activities that go on throughout the year for education about child abuse and the dynamics of it. And once people become aware that it really happens, there can be more heightened understanding of what to look for. And then if they see it happen, they can report it. And you'd want to report those things to law enforcement or the Office of Children's Services. And I guess in a nutshell, it is about becoming aware that because it's a very difficult subject, and a lot of people don't want to deal with it because it is a very difficult thing to talk about. And so the more you become aware of it, the more you can possibly address it. It's a very complex issue.
George, you had mentioned some kind of community.
Well, let me go back and say, I think one of the reasons that we now have Child Abuse Prevention Month is because as a culture, we are learning a whole lot more about children. One way we think of it in medicine is that children are not little adults. And so many people are learning so much more about how to be a parent, preparation for being a parent, birthing classes, early childhood education, child care, all these things. And this is what's changing it. And
my wife both complained about the fact that our children came without manuals.
Right. and that's where the real prevention really occurs.
Yeah.
And it is slowly happening. And I want to stress that there is very good data that we are decreasing these numbers. There's what's called a national incident survey that's been done for a number of years. And between 1993 in 2006, there was a 25% reduction in sexual abuse, physical abuse, and emotional abuse in the United States.
Due to what?
Due to all these things that have been happening since the 70s and 80s. And when you hear everybody say, well, we're worse and it's already bad, I'm trying to say this takes time. And the single most important thing that any of us can do is to help parents and families and really appreciate their children. And it's the old cliche, it takes a village to raise a child. That's what children need. When we understand them, when we really love them, and we play with them, that's going to prevent abuse.
So does your agency, is there actively some program or some assistance program that people can come to help them learn those things?
Well, I work as a pediatrician. There is in Alaska what's called the Alaska Children's Trust Fund. And its primary purpose is the prevention of child abuse. And it has done this through a number of programs through the years. Home visiting was one of the biggest ones for a while. Now we are using what are called community cafes, and this is where we encourage people who are parents to get together and talk with others about being better parents. And here in Juneau, we have a particular one that we call the Father's Cafe, because one of the things that we see is that fathers are just as important as mothers in raising children, but they've sort of been left out of the equation. The other thing I want to stress is you cannot divorce domestic violence and child abuse. They go together. And I salute our governor because he is really focusing on that and getting us to think about how important it is to respect each individual. And I must add that another proof of success is the teens' pregnancy rate in the United States has been steadily dropping over the last 15 to 20 years. All these things have been going on, and you finally see the results. So Alaska's not nearly as bad as we think, but we still have a way to go.
Yeah, I certainly hear that. So this Father's Cafe or the community cafes, we just have a couple of seconds. When is the next possibility that someone could take advantage
of? These meet monthly. Our Father's Cafe meets the third Thursday each month from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Bartlett Hospital. The community cafe, which is for mothers and fathers together, they've changed their meeting dates, and they meet in different places in conjunction with child care places, but usually they meet on Mondays, and I'm sorry I can't give you the exact time for that.
If someone were seeking this out, is there a website or someplace that has their meeting material, meeting information on it?
What I would suggest that you do is have them call my office at Glacier Pediatrics, okay. 586-1542, and ask the question, and I'll make sure they get the answer.
Okay, so George Brown is at 586-1542 and can help you if you are interested in attending the Father's Cafe or the Community Cafe. Thank you, gentlemen. This is an extremely important topic. I appreciate your coming down and sharing some of these things with us.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. As a boy, Teddy Roosevelt's love of the outdoors led him to learn and mimic the songs and calls of hundreds of birds. He went on to establish our country's system of national parks, what the writer Wallace Stegner called America's best idea. Our childhood experiences of nature stay with us for a lifetime. Author Richard Louv, in his book Last Child in the Woods, talks about nature deficit disorder. He believes that direct exposure to nature is essential for the physical and emotional health of children and adults. But someone may have to show children the way to delight in and know the natural world. Otherwise, they may never get their feet wet in a local stream, may never know the names and songs of the birds they see, know nothing about the amazing journey those birds make during migration.
Who thinks they know the name of this tree?
I don't know, but my mom said it's a conifer,
right? Because it makes...
It's today's kids who will be tomorrow's stewards of the natural world. Many Audubon chapters across the country offer excellent summer camps. A website called Nature Rocks has great resources for families. Join organized activities or create your own adventures. Now is the time. We'll help you find what's right for you. Begin with a visit to our website, birdnote.org.
It's 19 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. A quick announcement here. There is a public reception tonight celebrating the opening of the Coastal Temperate Rainforest Symposium. It'll be held from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Centennial Hall in the Sheffield Ballroom 1 and 2. This is the beginning of a symposium that will last a longer period of time. The public reception will start at 5:30 p.m. John Pugh from the University of Alaska Southeast, the chancellor, will be talking, making opening remarks. His keynote speech is called Alaska's Place in the Future of Conservation. The keynote speaker is Peter Caravia, who is Chief Scientist and Director of Science at the Nature Conservancy. I guess that's the topic of his speech. So tonight, the public reception, 5:30 at Centennial Hall for the beginning of the Coastal Temperate Rainforest Symposium. Checking that weather one more time, partly cloudy, scattered rain showers, highs around 52, southeast winds 15 miles per hour tonight. It's supposed to stay partly cloudy, lows around 37, light winds. They've said that to us every day this week, and its sun has shone like a bomb every week. It's lovely, isn't it? I have two ladies in the studio with me now from the League of Women Voters, and we're going to talk about a program called Vision 2020. Barbara Belknap is here and Carolyn Brown. Hi.
Hello. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. Tell us, Barbara, about this Vision 2020 program.
Well, the big event tonight is the showing of the movie Made in Dagenham. And Made in Dagenham is a story of women in England who struck for equal pay in the 1960s. And because of their strike and what happened after that, England had an equal pay law that was passed. So Vision 2020 is a program with Drexel University. There's two women from every state and the District of Columbia, and I am one of the two delegates from Alaska to Vision 2020. It's a program that began in 2000, and by 2020, Vision 2020 wants to see increase the number of women in senior leadership positions, achieve pay equity, which is what I'm working on, educate employers about policies and practices that enable men and women to share family responsibilities, educate new generations of girls and boys to respect their differences, and mobilize women to vote with a record-setting turnout in 2020. So I am the delegate. My job as the delegate is to get information out about this program and to work on equal pay for women.
Who's the other delegate from Alaska?
Terry Tibbett.
From
Juneau.
From Juneau. Okay.
Yeah, the two women are from Juneau.
Okay. And you'll be going to where for the big meetings?
The first one was in Chicago. That was my first one in the fall. I just got appointed in October. The next one will be in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. And how long will Vision 2020 continue?
Until 2020.
Oh, okay. So you're...
but my term is a three-year term.
Okay.
So at the end of 3 years, some other woman from Alaska will become a delegate. And the Vision 2020 has a huge list of partner organizations across the country, and the League of Women Voters is one of those. And I'm also a member of the Juneau League, so that's why the League is partnering with Vision 2020 on this project.
I see. Okay. And in the greater picture of Vision 2020 from the other 49 states, are most of the delegates involved with League of Women Voters, or are they from other...
No, they're involved with all kinds of women's organizations. I met a woman who's the chief of an Indian tribe in Wyoming. You know, there's women. I met a lot of African-American women from the Midwest and the South who are anything from ministers to social workers to CEOs. It's a tremendously diverse group of women that really represents, I think, America. It's exciting.
Carolyn, you're part of the state and local boards for,
and you're
also a delegate to the national board. So you'll be going off to conventions here shortly.
Pretty soon, yes. I'm very eager to sit on the board for the National League of Women. There's a lot of work to be done, and that's very, very top drawer, high power. It's a privilege to do that.
Uh-huh. And will you be involved in the Vision 2020 program that she's...
Only as I can help Barbara do the job, but because the League, both national, state, and local, are supporting 2020, we're a part of what she's doing, and we want to support her wherever we can. And, of course, her project is equal pay for equal work, and this is a very strong point and position statement for the League of Women Voters.
Well, I don't want to pin you down to exact numbers, but can you give us an idea of what the scope of the problem is? How much disparity, how do you measure the disparity between pay for work for women and men?
The disparity is measured by taking the mean income of men and women across the same type of jobs, and then you do the math, and the math comes out that women make about 75 cents on average for every dollar that women make. And what got me started on this was an article in the Juneau Empire last April after the Juneau Economic Development did their report, and I was stunned to see the disparity in Alaska with women. I always thought women had a better shake here, but it's not true.
So what is the statistic for Alaska?
42% in Juneau is
the
men
on average
less
for similar jobs.
Yeah. And in Anchorage, you know, in just to give you an example, in Juneau, the average male salary was $41,000. The average women's salary was $29,000. And the gap was the same in Anchorage and Fairbanks and across the state. And I was really quite surprised.
And those salary numbers you're talking about are some kind of block average
medium,
across
yeah,
all of the
yeah.
Across
you know, that
all jobs.
Includes... You know, and the closest women get is government, but they're still not pay equity. And part of the problem that, you know, we were talking about earlier, Carol and I were talking about, is that there are places where you get fired if you talk about what you make. So women don't know what the man next to them is making. And that was the Lilly Ledbetter Act was part of that she worked for years in the mine and had no idea she was getting paid way less than the men next to her. And so there's a new law in the works, the Paycheck Fairness Act, that says that you cannot retaliate against your employees if they talk about what they make.
This is federal legislation.
This is federal legislation because it's really stunning how many places will punish or fire even someone who talks about what they make. So women don't know that the man next to her is making more than her because there's no way for her to know that. She may just assume that it's fair, when in fact it's not fair.
Not a good assumption.
No, it is not a good assumption, like all assumptions.
Yeah. So what does 2020, what kinds of advocacy measures are you out of the meetings that you've had in Chicago? And
well, my first meeting, I was quite interested to see what could be done about fair pay, because it's a really tough nut to crack. You know, you get law after law after law, and it still is pervasive, this thing. So there was just a lot of conversation about what to do about it. Education is one thing, letting people know about the laws and letting women know about the laws. But for the most part, it's just a constant education process to find out one of the things that that I'm doing is a video for women to learn how to negotiate. Women are taught from an early age not to negotiate in a very subtle way. We're not, you know, as a rule, you know, we're not really that great at negotiating. And so women will be offered a salary and take it. The first offer, thank you very much. And maybe go home and kick themselves saying, you know, really, I should have asked for more. But so I'm doing a video. We're making a video. Clint Farr and Heather Page here in Juneau are creating a video that actually shows a woman being interviewed for a job. And she accepts the first officer. Then we do offer, and then we do a redo where she negotiates and says, you know, with my experience and what I bring to the table, I think I'm worth more, which is something a lot of men do. But women generally do not do. And so we're going to put that up on YouTube.
We're
crediting the Juneau League of Women Voters because of their tremendous support and Vision 2020. But something practical that we can do until employers follow the law.
Yeah. I was sitting here wondering if from these comments that you've been making about wage disparity, the League of Women Voters comes out of a history of the legislation that gave women the vote.
Correct.
Is there still poll discrimination against women? Or do women vote less than men? Or is any of that still alive?
Oh, I think it is in some places, depending on what part of the country you live in and who's running and what power they have. I think women in Alaska do pretty well, don't you, Barbara?
Yeah,
I wonder if there's any research.
I think that women are voting more and more. I mean, that I don't want to get into all the politics right now, but part of the conversation right now is about women voting and who women will vote for. And if you don't support equal pay or you don't support prevention of violence against
candidates,
women, and all of those issues that are really important, I think you suffer at the polls for it.
And, of course, one of the big things that the League of Women Voters is very strong on is getting people registered to vote.
Yes.
And this is probably our flagship of what we do in the League of Women Voters.
What kinds of activities are you anticipating to register people to vote for the next election?
Well, we already do a great deal of it. We go to naturalization ceremonies. And we're there every time there's a bunch of people, and it's a beautiful, beautiful service to watch. There can be 8 people or 30 people who are new citizens. We register kids at the end of their high school years. All of those who are 18 are going to be 18 within 90 mm-hmm. days of voting. We have been to Yakutsk and registered those young people, and we're now undertaking a project at University of Alaska from now until November to get as many of those young people registered as possible. So we'll go to health fairs. We'll go wherever there's anybody that we can register to vote.
How many members do you have?
Statewide, I think we have about 300.
How about in Juneau?
Juneau has the largest one. We have almost 100 people here.
Mm. So those are the people who are doing all of this work that you're talking about,
yes.
going to all of these
yes.
places. So
yes.
it's a huge volunteer thing.
Yes.
If a woman is not a member of the League and wanted to join, how would she do so?
She can simply notify any of us, and we'll be more than happy to make that registration available. We're looking for anybody. And men can also be members of the League of Women Voters. My dear husband is a member.
Hmm. You have a nice website, too, that people can
yes,
go to get more information, I noticed this
yes.
morning. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, our time is just almost up. Are there any upcoming immediate activities that someone might want to take advantage of?
Maid in Dagenham at the Goldtown Nickelodeon
right.
Theater, 7 o'clock. It's a great movie. It's by the same people that did The Crying Game and some other huge movies. It's about women at the Ford Motor Company who struck for equal pay and better conditions. And it's
yeah.
really great. It's
okay.
a terrific movie. 7 o'clock, $5 donation at the door, which is really reasonable.
And that money goes to the League of Women
and it
Voters?
It does,
yeah.
yes.
Which we've just figured out goes to a pretty good cause here.
It goes to a great cause.
One very last must give credit to all the people who are helping bring this movie here. Of course, the League of Women Voters, but also the Juneau Pro-Choice Coalition, the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and, of course, Vision 2020. We're all part and parcel of bringing this movie tonight. 7 o'clock, $5 at the door. We hope you'll be there.
Well, thank you for bringing this all to us, and I hope you have good work at your upcoming conferences.
Thank you very much.
Representing
Appreciate
Alaska.
It.
Thank you.
Broadcast support comes from McDonald's, now serving strawberry and cream pie and featuring McCafe strawberry shakes. McDonald's is open daily in the Valley at 2285 Trout Street.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 17th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of the writer who said, "My advice to you is not to inquire why or whither, but just enjoy your ice cream while it is on your plate." Thornton Wilder, born Madison, Wisconsin, 1897. Father was a diplomat. Wilder and his 4 brothers and sisters moved back and forth between Asia and the United States. Went to Oberlin, then to Yale, got a job teaching French at a boys' boarding school. In 1926, he spent the summer at McDowell Colony, Writer's Retreat in New Hampshire, and he started work on his new novel, The Bridge of San Luis Rey, set in the 18th century, story of a bridge that collapses in Lima, Peru, while 5 people are crossing it, the collapse witnessed by a Franciscan monk who becomes obsessed by it and tries to figure out why those 5 people had to die. Wilder finished it less than a year later. It was an immediate success, sold nearly 300,000 copies, which enabled him to quit his job and build a house for himself and his parents and his sisters in Hamden, Connecticut, which was his residence for the rest of his life. His plays were popular, especially Our Town, and his play The Matchmaker, which was adapted into the musical Hello, Dolly. Somewhere every day, the play Our Town is being performed by somebody. And Emily says her line, "Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to realize you. Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it every minute?" When he was 65, Thornton Wilder, famous writer, comfortable in Connecticut, busy being a literary man, he decided to escape from his own life and got in his Thunderbird convertible, drove west for 10 days. His car broke down in Arizona, just outside of Douglas, Arizona, and he got himself a hotel room, and he stuck around for almost a year and got started on a novel, which came out 4 years later, The Eighth Day, and it won a National Book Award. Here's a poem for today by Mark Irwin, entitled For Jackson Pollock. In April, our new black-finned 1957 Ford Fairlane 500 was headed north on Route 23 towards Big Stone Gap when a semi-tractor trailer jackknifed in a thundershower turned hail and scattered Muriel cigars all over a green Virginia hillside. The driver, dazed, was ambulanced away while my father and dozens of other men combed that hillside, gathering up the blunts, the panatellas, and the coronas they lit with so many small fires in the twilight. And as the sky cleared and the rhododendrons flared gold, as the sun drifting somewhere over Kentucky, those men continued to discuss over and over how the big rig had so benignly split apart, multiplying the sleek, back-haired gypsy with the red scarf, red beads, and red lips, all over that green hillside, and how the driver had escaped without so much as a hangover or a nosebleed. For Jackson Pollock, a poem by Mark Irwin from his collection Quick, Now, Always, published by Boa Editions Limited, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Reputation.com, offering patented protection for the online reputations of professionals and businesses, now including reputation assessments. Learn more at reputation.com. Written by Betsy Alistair, be well, do good work, keep in touch.
It's 23 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore hosting Juno Afternoon today. My guests in the studio are two of the people who had the biggest jobs, I guess, the senior editor and junior editor, Tom Bay and Alexander Brown, for the Tidal Echoes, which is launching its 2012 issue on Friday evening at 7 p.m. up on the UAS campus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's see. Let's start over here with the junior editor. We'll let the senior kind of wail with this whole thing. So, Alexandra, what was your job in putting together the book? And tell us a little about the book too.
Okay. Well, so we get submissions in from all over Southeast Alaska, as well from the UAS students. And so, part of my job was to read through all of these submissions and to help. To help sort of pick out which ones got to be published in the journal. I also got to help format and set up the table of contents, write the acknowledgments page. So there was really a lot of work involved. Overall, it was a very rewarding experience.
While doing your junior year in creative writing. So this had to happen in and around homework assignments and all that sort of stuff.
I really enjoyed sort of doing all of it. It's like instead of having to go home and read Walden, I got to go home and read, things like... poetry and memoir that, you don't really get to see anywhere else. So that was really exciting.
Now, this isn't a fair question for the editor of a book, but is it good?
Oh my God, yes. I've probably read each piece about 15 times, and I still kind of find little surprises in it. But it's just different. I guess there's only a few literary journals that I've read before, but I think that this has such a Southeast Alaskan taste to it. It's very unique. So. Uh-huh.
We'll get to the details of the book in just a moment. I wanted to ask Tom, is the senior editor's job different from what she's described?
The only really big difference is I've gone through everything that she had she's done this year, last year.
Mm-hmm.
And basically...
Yeah, you're on a two-year internship.
Yeah, it's a two-year internship program. There's a junior editor and a senior editor. The first year, you're the junior editor. The second year, you're the senior editor. And when you're the senior editor, you kind of have to get ready to hand the ropes over to the junior editor because that person's going to take over next year.
Right.
But I've done basically everything that she already listed, and we do everything kind of as a group. It works a lot better that way, and we get a lot of help from our editorial board as well.
How big is the board?
The board is around 10 people. We have a bunch of faculty members, some of us students here, and then a couple other people that live in Juneau. And it's a pretty good process, and it works out really well in the end.
Mm-hmm.
This year we had 300 submissions, up from 210 last year. So we've had a huge increase in popularity and everything, and we owe that to Jacqueline Boucher, she was our fall intern, and it was her duty to get all of the submissions.
Thanks to her, she went around to all the poetry slams, all the bigger events, and was really advocating for the journal, and that's sort of what brought in so many submissions.
Tell me about the range of what's in the journal. There's prose and poetry and a couple of original art pieces as well.
Mm-hmm.
Any comic art?
Actually, there is one. Uh-huh. I think it's called
one.
She Never Understood His Hipster Ways. very funny.
Yeah.
We've got ceramics, we have mixed media, there's charcoal, acrylics, as well as poetry, memoir, fiction. I'm trying to think of what else. We did get a couple of submissions of plays.
There's even a haiku in there.
Haiku as well from Nora Dauenhauer.
And you said it had a native, or it had a Southeast Alaska flavor to it. Is there a keynote piece or a piece that you could point to that kind of exemplifies that?
That's kind of hard.
If you've got Nora Dauenhauer in there,
we have both
sitting
Nora
right on
Richard,
the center of Southeast Alaska.
Actually, there is one haiku in here from Nora that is, I think, very Southeast Alaskan.
Can you read it?
Yeah, it's called Untitled. It goes, "The morning sky, red, like the salmon strips hanging in the smokehouse." Very short and beautiful haiku.
Very nice. Very nice. I can close my eyes and see it. that's Nora. She's wonderful. She's been on the show with me a couple of times, and her pieces are always startling like that.
She's a really good writer.
She is. She has an amazing inner eye, sees the world wonderfully well. What will happen Friday night?
Friday night, we're going to have our book launch. It's going to be at the Egan Lecture Hall at 7 p.m. We ask that people get there around 6:45 for good seating. What's going to happen is we're going to have our featured writer and featured artist out there. Our featured writer this year is Kim Hecox, and then our featured artist is Patrice Helmar.
What's Kim's submission?
Kim's submission is a memoir that he has not published yet, but he has it in our journal. I guess it is published now.
And the artist's work is?
Patrice Helmar is a photographer here in Juneau. She's a local photographer, and she's got pieces throughout the journal.
And will she have other works on display at the...
I'm not sure if she's going to have other work out on display there, but the work that she has in there is beautiful, and you'll be able to see it when it comes out.
Okay.
Our writer and our artist will each have 20 minutes to talk about their work, and then afterwards they'll each have a 5-minute Q&A session for anybody that might have any questions. Also, aside from that, we're going to be having five people who live in Juneau and are published, or no, yeah, five people who live in Juneau and are published in the journal. They're going to be reading. We're going to have four people who are writers, and we're going to have one person who is one of the artists in the journal.
And there'll be, I assume, some way to get your copy autographed right there.
Of course, yes.
And are they going to be for sale?
They are going to be for sale. Yeah. All of the journals will be on sale for $5 at the door. We're going to be staying behind for a few minutes if anybody wants to have any signatures from either the writer, the artist, or any of us editors.
Or the fabulous editor in
general. Yeah, or if they want to come up and tell us how good it was.
Yeah.
Now,
next year, you're in the hot seat, right?
Yes.
Who's your junior, do you know yet?
Megan Stangland. She's also published in the book, as well as she won the Mac Barron's Award.
Uh-huh.
So she's a very, an insanely talented writer and I'm really glad to have worked with her. We were actually in gymnastics together when we were like 7, 8 years old, so I have known her for quite a while.
So the two of you will be the core of the team for the next one, and you've got good faculty advisors lined up for next year and all that for the board.
Yeah, we get to work with Emily again, and she's just fantastic.
Sounds like a wonderful opportunity. Tom, you're unfortunately not going to be at the university next year, having graduated in with your BLA in psychology.
Yes, unfortunately not, no. Yes, I'll be graduated here in a couple weeks, actually, with a primary emphasis in psychology and a secondary emphasis in creative writing.
Uh-huh.
It's been long overdue, but I'm super happy to get it over with. But I'm sure if they ever need help in the future, I'll be there to help.
Well, good enough. Well, thank you very much. I hope you have a good turnout tomorrow, Friday night, 7 p.m. at the Egan Lecture Hall. And this is the launch of the Tidal Echoes book for the year. Bring $5. Be there at 6:45, right?
Mm-hmm.
About 13 minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. The tune was Busker on the Bridge, and it's by an outfit called Night Noise. I kind of like their sound. I love that Gaelic pipe. Anyway, I have folks here from the Juneau School District to talk to us about the important days that are coming up when you register your children for kindergarten. So joining me in the studio are Dave Stoltenberg, who's the elementary principal at Harborview, and Debbie Bagnett, who's one of the kindergarten teachers. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
So tell us what people have to do.
Well, this Thursday, April 19th at 1:30, all of the schools in the Juneau District will be having their kindergarten registration, and we are hopeful that lots of parents with their kindergarten students that will be entering kindergarten next year will be coming in to register. That will help us give an accurate count of how many kindergartners we're going to anticipate coming into the system and how many teachers we'll need and that sort of thing.
Right. And so is there like a deadline that you have to have your child registered for kindergarten by?
There isn't a deadline. We would love to have everybody come in as close to the Thursday day that we've this week. What happens if we don't know how many people or kids are coming into the school system, then, of course, it delays the process of exactly how many teachers we need. And so we'll be forming classes this summer, and that's very helpful. Of course, we'll have registration go on continuous to the end of the school year and throughout the summer as well.
Mm-hmm. Debbie, is kindergarten required?
Actually, was there just a bill that was passed that was talking about five-year-olds needing to be in school?
So, well, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
I think traditionally that it was not required, but I think that might be changing within the state. I read something on that. So the important date is September 1.
Okay.
Because the question is your child, has your child turned 5 by September 1?
Yeah.
That's the cutoff date. So if your child is 5 on September 1, they are a candidate for kindergarten, and we're excited about our new crop of kids coming in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like Dave said, it's important to be coming to that April 19th. It's really an open house situation on the 19th from 1:30 to 5. The kindergarten teachers will be there for at least the first hour and a half or 2 hours, and they'll be able to meet with all the families who come. So we would encourage parents to come, but also, you know, feel really good about bringing your kids. It gives them a chance to see the classroom and meet the teacher and get a chance to probably do a few activities, maybe get just a little bit more comfortable and able to see themselves as a child in the school system the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And I think, too, the kids and the parents will get an idea of the schedule, what a schedule looks like in the day and life of a kindergartner. They'll be introduced to the different specials that occur, like library, PE, music, those sorts of things. And parents will have an opportunity to talk with principals, to talk with teachers, and just have questions answered that they might have about kindergarten and what to expect or what happens.
I think the classic concept of kindergarten is that it's, you know, art and a nap and like that. But really, the educational model has been to drive down curriculum down to fifth grade or five-year-olds. So there's actually learning and reading and even some mathematics and stuff like that. Well, arithmetic at that point, but it's also math and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you move just a little bit closer to that microphone?
Sure.
I don't want you to be muffled.
The Juneau School District has followed the national trend to increase standards at each grade level, and that includes kindergarten. So we have power standards or power core standards for each of the different grade levels. Where we are aiming for a rigorous curriculum for even our five-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, absolutely, kids will be exposed to and be clearly, explicitly taught just the fundamentals of reading and of writing and also of mathematics.
At the kindergarten level.
At the kindergarten level,
and there's also a renewed emphasis, I think, it's been a growing emphasis in the school district on physical conditioning, physical health, and learning games early and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
we have those programs in effect here or in place here, too.
We do. There's a gym teacher in every building, and all kindergarten students will participate in a physical education program on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And then you mentioned music as well?
Yep, they have music teachers, so they'll have music, they'll have PE, they'll have library, they'll have a counselor as well. So we've got counseling programs as well. One thing I was going to inform parents, too, it would be important to bring a copy of their birth certificate to the registration and also any immunization records that they might have as well.
And if someone did not have those things by April 19th, I'm assuming they should still come. And
yeah, absolutely.
Just
and if they don't have them, we'll provide every opportunity for them to get it in. Before school starts, of course, they have to have their immunization records in.
Right.
But, yeah, we've got a lot of time yet.
Okay. Well, wonderful to know that this is coming up. The event is from 1:30 to 5 on April 19th, and it takes place where?
In every elementary school.
Okay.
So parents would...
Go to their neighborhood schools.
Figure out where their neighborhood school. And if you're not sure and you live in the valley, you could call any of the schools and tell them your address, and they can tell you which school is your attendance area.
Okay. I'm noticing a couple of things on your poster here, too. From 2 to 4 on Tuesday, April 3rd, there was a thing at the community charter school. That's passed now, but I suppose if someone were trying to still take advantage of the community charter school, they might be able to contact them. And then if you miss the open house, then the registrations are from April 20 through June 1st.
Absolutely.
And the really critical date that you mentioned is if a child is 5 by September 1st. If your child is 5 by September 1st, then they are ready for kindergarten, right?
You got it.
Okay.
Hey, we'll be happy to see them.
Yeah, yeah. We're excited to have the parents and the kiddos come in. So,
yeah, wonderful. Well, yeah. We'll look forward to a big show, a big turnout at 1:30 at all the schools around town.
All right.
Thanks,
take care.
Pat.
I know you've been seeing me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. Oh yeah. If you think that I don't know about the little tricks you play and never see you when deliberately you put things in my way, well, here's a poke at you. You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile, because all the while I could see for miles.
Every once in a while, there's an interesting happening here, and we had a drop-in at the studio. Romano Scaturro is with me here, and John Alves joined him, and Romano is planning on going under his own power, without any motors involved, to all of the 50 states. He's starting here in Juneau and is leaving tomorrow. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what brought this mission on?
Gee, that's a good question. I have been traveling.
You were sitting around one day and thought.
Yeah. I've actually been asked that question before. The title of my trip is 50 at 50. And next January I'll be 50 years old. And I thought it'd be pretty neat to see if I could travel to all 50 U.S. state capitals using only human-powered means of travel. At 50 years of age.
So, and so what human means of travel are you planning on utilizing?
Juneau is accessible, obviously, as you know, by sea craft and aircraft, so I'll have to kayak to the nearest road, which I found is in Skagway.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I'll dump the kayak and get on my bike and proceed to ride to 48 land-based capitals in the lower 48.
How's your bike getting to Skagway?
I'm having it sent up there by aircraft.
Okay, so the equipment can travel by...
Correct. No. I did a meeting with some children, and they asked me how I was going to pull the rowboat, the 20-foot rowboat behind me in my on my bicycle.
So, John, how do you fall into this this adventure?
Oh, well, I'm a longtime friend of Romano's, and it was probably 3 months ago when he made me aware of what he was doing. And he said, "Hey, you want to do a kayak up in the Skagway?" And I thought about it for a couple of days, and then I was like, "Yeah, that'd be a great thing to do." I wish I could join him along and do the bike ride and so forth. But in all respect, and I'm confident he can do it, the rowboat to Hawaii. But I drew the line there. I told him I'd join him in doing the 65-mile kayak ride. And then from there, when I go back home, there's several of us in support of Romano that we're going to contact. We're kind of appointed, each one of us, probably 4 or 5 different states to where we contact local radio stations and the TV stations and promoting this good deed. I'm sure he can tell us more about that, along with his trek, that the drive that goes along with it, and I'm pretty much his rally monkey.
So we have just a couple of minutes that we can talk about the fact that you're involved with an organization called Frank.
Correct.
And what is Frank?
Frank is an acronym for Family Ride Across America to Nurture Kids. That's Frank with 2 A's.
Yeah.
We have a website, frank.org, And I organized Frank back in 2006 because I do so many of these summer trips every year. And basically to raise awareness and funds for local and nationally based charities. 50 at 50 is dedicated to raising $50,000, of which 100% of all donations go to the beneficiaries. The beneficiaries, primary beneficiaries for 50 of 50 will be two or three local children and their families. We have two beneficiaries on already. One of them is a young lady, 13 years old, who will need a liver and a lung transplant within the next 2 years. She's already
Juno,
on the list.
Pardon me? Is this a Juno girl or is this?
This is a young girl in our community of Cornville, Arizona, which is where we're from.
Yeah, okay.
And the other boy is in need of a, he will, matter of fact, he's in the process of having a bone marrow transplant as he has leukemia. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, we're out of time. We wish you good luck with your mission. Are you blogging or romano@frank.org is where folks can...
frank.org, Frank with two A's, and I am blogging. Yesterday was the first posting.
Okay, good. So check out the blog and follow Romano's adventure as he travels to all 50 states in his 50th year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
You're still in tune with KTOO. We broadcast on translators throughout the area. We're on K276 AF at 103.1 in the Valley and Auk Bay and Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. It's K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on KTOO, K210AS at 89.9.